comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the Bush administration holds emergency meetings on Iraq.
This is a very important turning point that they're basically conceding that the plan up to date has not worked and they're looking for a new one.
The EU threatens huge import taxes on American products, from orange juice to motorboats, if the U.S. refuses to eliminate steel tariffs. Who will blink first?
Prescription drug prices in Canada increase. Canadians blame Americans.
And journalist Dan Kennedy writes about understanding his daughter's dwarfism.
Becky, I realized, was the first dwarf I'd ever seen, not counting television, or maybe once or twice in the flesh, in a crowd, off in the distance.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. At least 15 Italians and 8 Iraqis were killed today in a suicide bombing in southern Iraq. The attack occurred at the Italian military police base in Nasiriya. The BBC's Paul Adams surveyed the damage from across the Euphrates River.
This was clearly a devastating attack. We're not being allowed to approach close to the Italian headquarters, but from a vantage point across the Euphrates River, the damage is clearly visible. The entire front of the three-story building has been torn off. A large crane has been brought in, presumably to remove rubble. Eyewitnesses speak of a huge detonation at about 10:30 this morning. They say a petrol truck approached along a riverside road before exploding in front of the building.
The BBC's Paul Adams in Nasiriya. Reacting in Rome, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi said the bombing won't deter his country's commitment to help rebuild Iraq. Meanwhile, the U.S. Administrator for Iraq, Paul Bremer, concluded another meeting with President Bush and his top advisors at the White House today. Bremer's disagreeing with critics who say the U.S.-created Iraqi Governing Council isn't working. He insisted that the United States will continue to work with the council despite setbacks and tragedies like today's bombing.
I am completely confident and optimistic about the outcome in Iraq, but we will face some difficult days like today when we had the attack on the Italian soldiers in the south. We're going to have difficult days ahead because the terrorists are determined to deny the Iraqis the right to run their own country. We're not going to let them get away with that.
Bremer says time's growing short for the Iraqi Governing Council to complete writing a constitution. The deadline is December 15th. The Chicago School Board has clinched a tentative contract with the Chicago Teachers Union. The move comes after weeks of intense negotiations and a threat to strike. From Chicago Public Radio, Katherine Einhorn reports.
An 18-hour bargaining session ended early this morning with good news for Chicago parents, a tentative deal between teachers and the school board. The Chicago Teachers Union refuses to discuss details of the contract until it's released to rank and file members tomorrow. The school board will only say the proposal addresses the union's major issues. Those issues, higher health care costs, the length of the contract, and longer workdays in exchange for a shorter school year, brought 33,000 union members to reject a previous proposal. Now they'll have the final say on whether to accept this new version. Union members are scheduled to take a strike authorization vote next Tuesday if an agreement isn't reached by then. Chicago teachers haven't gone on strike since 1987. Before that, parents and children suffered through 8 teacher strikes in 10 years. For NPR News, I'm Katherine Einhorn in Chicago.
The National Weather Service says up to 2 inches of rain has fallen across West Virginia. Schools are closed in 4 counties because of flooding. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 61 points at 97.99. The Nasdaq is up 23 at 19.54. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, new research suggests that spending on information technology is ready to rebound in 2004. Technology research company Gartner predicts that expenditures on products and services in IT should grow about 5% next year. From San Francisco, Jason Lopez has more.
The signs of a turnaround have been building in 2003. Traders point to the latest earnings figures from bellwethers such as Intel and Cisco, which reported growing sales. Such sales growth does not constitute a rebound in itself, but many market researchers think the signs of recovery are too important to ignore. Gartner projects 5% growth in IT spending next year and 6-7% in 2005. But the firm also predicts that huge changes are in store for high tech in the next 2 years, namely that half of the world's technology suppliers will be gobbled up in consolidation, affecting possibly millions of IT workers. Gartner foresees segments such as broadband, wireless, and Linux having a profound effect on business and consumers. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
A French court has convicted three former officials of the French oil company Elf of fraud. Elf's former chairman and director and a third company officer have been fined hundreds of thousands of dollars and ordered to spend at least 4 years in prison. One of the officers' ex-wives has also been convicted. French prosecutors have tried at least 37 people connected to the oil company on charges of embezzlement. The prosecutors say some $345 million were stolen from the company during the late 80s and early 90s. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The top people in the Bush administration, including the president himself, are huddling today with their man in Baghdad, Paul Bremer. It's a second day of meetings with Bremer, who was called back unexpectedly. On the line from Washington is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. And Robin, why was Paul Bremer called back so suddenly? Is there any sense that he himself might be the problem?
No. In fact, there was a rumor that swept Washington yesterday that Bremer was called back to be fired. In fact, it's just the opposite. He has probably never been closer to President Bush. Their sessions are reflected again today. They're going to have a one-on-one after the full National Security Council meeting. The question really is the kind of faith the U.S. has in its own hand-picked governing council, 24 members still surviving, one was assassinated, who have failed to be able to come to any agreement on the critical issues at any given time. Up to half of them are either out of the country or out of Baghdad. At some occasions, only three or four or five show up at a meeting. They send their representatives or no one else. So the process itself is kind of broken, and that's the focus at the moment.
Now we hear of a top-secret CIA report leaked to the press, basically says that what we've been hearing before, that things are going badly in Iraq. Is this report significant?
Well, it reflects the urgency of the situation and the fact that the administration is concerned that things aren't going well at any level. So there's, a part of the reason for the discussions at the White House today are to find a mechanism that will confer greater legitimacy on the Iraqi body and that then the United States will become less of a target themselves.
But can you impose legitimacy on a governing council that so far has shown no sign of gaining legitimacy among Iraqis? How do you do that?
Bill, that's the key question. It looks like they're trying to move beyond the governing council, that they would allow the governing council to remain the authority while they come up with a basic law that would then allow elections for a constitutional committee that would also select some kind of new executive that would attain sovereignty. And this would be much like the model in Afghanistan, where the president, Hamid Karzai, gained sovereignty very early in the political process, not at the end of it. So that's more of the model the U.S. is discussing at the moment.
Though, of course, Hamid Karzai doesn't control much of his own country. A shadow on this meeting today, certainly, Robin, this huge truck bomb at the Italian police headquarters in Nasiriyah.
Well, yes. And one of the things of deep concern to the administration is the fact that any country, any neutral international humanitarian group that's in Iraq is now vulnerable. Whoever is targeting these people have now gone after not the Italians today, but more recently the Turks and the Jordanians, as well as the United Nations and the International Red Cross. And that's an indication that the strategy is to isolate the United States and make it the only power remaining in Iraq.
Robin, a lot of commentary out there that the administration has been making up its policy in Iraq as it goes along.
What is your sense from where you sit in Washington? Is that a legitimate criticism?
Well, the administration will put it in different terms. They talk about flexibility, that they're not locked into any set of rules by which to govern post-war Iraq. Yes, it is a work in progress, clearly, and this is a very important turning point that they're basically conceding that the plan up to date has not worked, and they're looking for a new one. Yesterday, someone said it was a sane and rational change of course.
Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent of The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Robin.
Sure.
Will the Bush administration lift tariffs on foreign steel as demanded by the European Union earlier this week? Or will the EU follow through with retaliatory taxes on U.S. exports, everything from motorboats to orange juice? The current face-off is coming close to a full-blown trade war with economic and political significance. Joining us on the line is Wall Street Journal reporter Neil King, Jr. And Neil, remind us, the Bush administration imposed these tariffs on incoming foreign steel back in March of 2002. Why?
It was complicated as to why. They came into office at that time, well, the year before, decided to begin an investigation on how this, basically the perils that the domestic industry was suffering from. And they decided to go forward with this whole program, in part in a kind of complicated trade-off in a way where they would buy support within Congress for other free trade initiatives, of which the administration is pursuing many, and being kind of protectionist on the one side. So it was a kind of a grand bargain in ways to be protectionist, protect the steel industry, give it time to consolidate at the same time as trying to push forward on some other free trade initiative.
Right. And now not only are foreign competitors unhappy, but American companies are saying that these tariffs have cost more American jobs than they've saved in the steel industry. How is that?
It's likely that's the case. It's a hard thing to tally, but it's made steel more expensive for American producers who use steel to make everything from cars to washing machines to tin cans to kegs of beer and all those sort of things. And in turn, at a very difficult time for the manufacturing sector over the last year and a half. So they've been screaming loudly. Foreign competitors have been screaming loudly. And this has become, in many ways, much larger a deal in a kind of symbolic way than some of the reality of it would actually warrant in some way, because it affects a fairly small amount of steel and so on. But the Europeans and others are very, very mad over this.
Well, and they're saying they won't compromise. The Bush administration has said in the past it won't lift the tariffs. So who do you think is going to blink?
My hunch, if I have to gamble on it, would be that there is going to be a bit of a compromise on both sides. The Europeans will become a little less strident, and the Bush administration will put forward something that will save face and say, you know, we'll phase them out altogether over the next 6 months or something like that, and that the Europeans and others would probably decide not to pull the trigger on what could be a very divisive trade war if they have a date certain when they would go away.
Well, and how, if the president does go that route and offer some compromise, how is that going to affect him in this, the election year?
It's an interesting thing. I mean, the steelworkers and their retirees and relatives and all them are a very energized and kind of angry bunch that can mobilize votes in important places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, et cetera. On the other hand, the union, the main steelworkers union, has already endorsed Dick Gephardt for president. And they're not known for being strong Republicans by any means. So it's not as if he would be losing a big vote that he might otherwise have gained, as much as that he might energize them to be all the more against him and get others to vote his way in states that matter a lot.
Well, and yes, I'm wondering if he's casting his eye on those people who make tin cans and kegs and cars.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because those people tend to be less of a consolidated voting bloc, but in many ways more important to the U.S. economy. I think that's the fear, is if he were to antagonize yet another group in other areas of the country who then get whacked in this thing that's not of their making, that might be more politically perilous.
And one last quick question, Neil. How is the steel industry in the U.S.? Is it recovered?
Well, it has recovered a bit. It has used these things to consolidate. They've made some deals with the unions and things like that. There are others, though, that argue that the industry is something that will almost always be in need of protection. And they've had these kinds of protections many times in the past decades, and then things get bad and they come back asking for them again. So it's better off now than it was a year and a half ago, but it's hard to say whether it's going to be perfectly viable going into the years ahead.
Well, Neil King, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Neil King, Jr., reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
sexual abuse by priests, gay marriage, and whether to excommunicate Catholic politicians who don't stick to church doctrine, especially on abortion. These are among issues taken up at this week's annual meeting of the U.S. Catholic bishops. Joining us on the line from the meeting in Washington is Michael Paulson. He's a staff writer for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Michael.
Hello.
Mike, could a Catholic politician who supports abortion rights really end up excommunicated by Catholic bishops?
Well, that's something the bishops are going to have to discuss over the coming months, but certainly there's a lot of frustration here with the number of Catholic politicians who disagree with church teachings on a lot of issues. And as a result of that frustration, the bishops are talking about whether there's some way that they could sanction those politicians who disregard church teachings.
That seems like a pretty nasty tone to be bringing to this gathering.
Yeah, it does. I think the bishops are in part responding to statements from the Vatican that attempt to guide Catholic politicians in the way they act on public policy.
Yeah. You know, Michael, as you may know, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry has quoted John F. Kennedy on the separation of church and state. I think the words in the Constitution are, no elected official should be limited or conditioned by any religious oath, ritual, or obligation. That was Kennedy's position. Why do you think that's not good enough for the bishops?
Well, you're right that a lot of Catholic politicians fall back on President Kennedy's words to justify their independence from Catholic teachings. But for the bishops, that's very frustrating. Some of them say that what they really need to do is attempt to persuade Catholics who run for elective office that the positions of the church are correct. But others of them say that they ought to do something more like punishing politicians by denying them the right to speak at Catholic institutions or by going as far as excommunicating them.
Boston's Archbishop Sean O'Malley has come out and acknowledged, he says, that the church has failed to explain clearly how it can love gay people but condemn marriage between gay people and their sexual practices. Under Catholic doctrine, gay sex is a sin. Any clarity on the horizon on gayness issues?
The Catholic bishops and the Vatican have become increasingly concerned as countries in Europe, as Canada, have moved to legalize gay marriage, and as the gay marriage debate has heated up around this country and in Massachusetts, where the Supreme Judicial Court is considering legalizing same-sex marriage. The bishops, again, are frustrated that their position, which opposes gay marriage, does not seem to be holding sway in the court of public opinion. So today they are to vote on a statement in a question and answer form that they plan to print as a brochure that again attempts to outline why it is that they oppose gay marriage and benefits for people who are in gay partnerships.
The National Review Board set up by the bishops to examine priestly sexual abuse gave an update yesterday. Anything new in that?
Well, they're moving to an important point. Next February, they will be releasing a much-anticipated study. It will be the first effort by the church to detail how many priests abused how many children over what period of time and how much it has cost the church. The church obviously has full access to this information. It's in their records, and this will be their first disclosure.
Yeah, Michael, so many people in this country having economic problems at the moment. Does anything come up at these meetings except sexuality?
Yeah, you know, this meeting is the first in some time that has not been completely dominated by sexuality. They had a fairly lengthy discussion about problems facing the church in Africa. On Sunday, they had a long session on war and peace issues and how to resolve conflicts within the church between pacifists and people who believe that war in some cases is justifiable. They do talk about economic issues, and they also talk about theological issues. So there's a lot going on here besides sexuality, but because of the importance of the sexual abuse crisis, that's what's tended to dominate the press coverage over the last few days.
Michael Paulson is a staff writer for the Boston Globe. Thanks very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a journalist researches the world of little people to better parent his daughter, born a dwarf.
And later in the program, are Canadians paying because Americans buy low-cost Canadian drugs?
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Becky, I realized, was the first dwarf I'd ever seen, not counting television, or maybe once or twice in the flesh, in a crowd, off in the distance, somewhere.
Journalist Dan Kennedy on finding out 11 years ago that his daughter Becky was born a dwarf. Nothing in Dan or his wife's experience prepared them for a dwarf child, for the unique respiratory illness that almost killed her, for the decisions that later had to be made about leg strengthening procedures or dealing with prejudice. So now Dan has written a book detailing the yellow brick road they traveled. Not to learn how to love Becky, that was no problem, but how to best parent her and help prepare her for life as a little person. The book is called Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes, and Dan Kennedy joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi, Robin.
We should say a friend of Here Now, been on the program before, but went away for a while to write this book.
That's right. I took 13 months off from the Phoenix to write this, but I've been back since March, and now the book is coming out.
Right. Boston Phoenix here in Boston, Massachusetts. Well, dwarfs. Midgets. First of all, are those acceptable terms to little people?
Dwarf today is probably considered the most acceptable term among a broad cross-section of the dwarf community. Little people is probably more popular with the older group that likes euphemisms. Mm. But sort of the younger, more politically aware people have kind of embraced dwarf as their own. Midget is not acceptable under any circumstances, which we never would have known before Becky was born and we started learning. Mm. There is a secondary meaning associated with midget in that it's thought to apply to people who are very short but whose proportions are the same as yours or mine. Right. Their arms and legs are not disproportionate. But that's really a secondary meaning. The primary meaning, and it only goes back to the 1860s, is a very small person, especially one displayed as a public curiosity. And I think that's the reason that the dwarf community has decided that this is just as unacceptable as the N-word mm-hmm. is in the African-American community.
Well, boy, the side roads that you go down, just as some examples, an exploration of the controversial limb lengthening surgery that some dwarfs undergo, famous dwarfs through the ages, dwarfs and eugenics, dwarfs during Nazi Germany. Were you constantly astounded?
I really was. This was a great opportunity for me to do because we had been living with Becky's dwarfism for, I guess, 9 years when I started this book, and we'd gotten to know a number of dwarf adults through Little People of America. But what had been missing in our lives was the broader context. Parents are busy people. Mm. You work, you raise your kids, and then you go back to work. Mm-hmm. So we really hadn't been able to immerse ourselves sort of in the culture of dwarfism to the degree that I would have liked to. So this was really a lot of education for me.
And you know, you've written it also for your daughter, obviously. It's something for her. Well, let's talk a little bit about Becky. I mean, there is so much in the culture of dwarfism, but let's talk about her. Just tick off a couple of the things that makes Becky's life different because she's a dwarf. I'm thinking reaching for things.
Right. I'm going to tell you one that wouldn't be obvious at all. People with achondroplasia, especially when they're kids, their ears do not drain properly. And it has been a constant, somewhat losing battle for us to keep her hearing normal. As you mentioned, there's the reaching. We move the cereal down to the floor so that she can make her own breakfast in the morning. There's the fact that she really can't keep up. I love to hike. My son loves to hike. She really can't go do the kind of hiking that we do. Mm. It wouldn't be good for her back because there are orthopedic issues involved as well.
And you know, we can think through that, oh, yes, dwarfs might need assistance driving a car. There's special pedals that they can use.
Right.
But what about the other thing? Do people stare at your daughter?
You know, I didn't used to think they did. And my wife always said, you're nuts. Of course they do. So there was a Labor Day weekend a couple of years ago where Becky and I went to Storyland up in New Hampshire. And I decided to, for once, just kind of stand back and look more carefully. And I noticed that people were looking. And, you know, they'd look and they'd kind of, you know, whisper to each other. And it kind of opened my eyes in a new way to the way other people see Becky.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not the norm.
Does she know it? Have you talked to her about being, as you say, different?
Oh, of course. We've certainly talked to her about that. Mm. And at her age, the abstract doesn't mean much to her. What she looks at is the very concrete, the fact that reaching is difficult, the fact that she can't necessarily ride on the amusement park ride she wants to go on without Dad being on with her, which irritates
Mortifying.
Her. You know, I don't really think she looks into the future particularly, and it's probably just as well because she's heading into her most difficult years. The teen years, I know, will be a challenge for her.
Mm. You, as I said, you talk about so many things in this book. One of the things you touch on is the new high technology that's allowing us to know more and more about defects in utero. This concerns you.
It does. A couple of years after Becky was born, the genetic anomaly that causes achondroplasia was discovered and identified and written about. So now it would be technically possible today to do amnio and detect achondroplasia. Genetics activists within LPA, Little People of America, and other parts of the disability rights movement are concerned that within a few years, it may be possible to do a very cheap test, pennies per test, and screen for, say, the 100 most common genetic differences. Mm-hmm. And I think that there would be a lot of terminated pregnancies as a result of this. You're eliminating diversity. You're eliminating essentially a difference that has been with humanity from the beginning.
Well, Dan Kennedy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's a terrific book, Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us your town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, prices for drugs like Cipro and Prozac are increasing in Canada. The elderly there are worried that they're paying for Americans buying cross-border drugs.
The U.S. wants to change a decade-old treaty limiting the use of certain pesticides.
And in New York, they call it performance art.
I had a suit jacket and some. I have these, panties with a big butterfly on them. Rub myself with the baby oil and what else did I do?
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. President Bush and his top foreign policy advisors are reviewing new strategies to speed the transfer of political power in Iraq. Paul Bremer, the chief U.S. administrator in Iraq, was called back to Washington for the discussions. He says he'll continue his talks with members of the Iraqi Governing Council.
I'll be taking them a message from the president that he remains steadfast in his determination to defeat terrorism in Iraq and steadfast in his determination to give the Iraqis authority over their country.
In Iraq, 25 people are dead, including 17 Italians, after a suicide truck bomber attacks the headquarters of Italy's paramilitary police in Nasiriyah today. Lourdes Navarro is in Iraq.
A truck bomb packed with explosives blew up at the gate of the Italian military compound in Nasiriyah mid-morning, causing a massive blast that damaged buildings in a wide area and reduced part of the headquarters of the Italians to rubble. Italian officials say some Italian soldiers may still be trapped beneath debris. Nasiriyah is a Shiite town which has been mostly quiet since the end of the war, but the attack caused chaos in the city. Ambulances could be seen racing from the scene while black smoke billowed over the area. This is the deadliest attack against non-Americans in the coalition since the occupation here began. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Officials in Israel say the Palestinians now have to live up to their conciliatory words. This after the Palestinian legislature approved a new cabinet, ending a 2-month political stalemate. The new prime minister, Ahmed Karea, is calling for an immediate ceasefire, and PLO leader Yasser Arafat joined him in calling for an end to 3 years of violence. A victory for prosecutors in the trial of suspected D.C. sniper John Muhammad. This morning, the judge in the trial dismissed 3 defense motions claiming prosecutors have not presented enough evidence to warrant a possible death sentence. Judge Leroy Millette ruled that there is, quote, clear evidence to support the charge Muhammad was the perpetrator. A New York State Supreme Court judge rules that neither Rosie O'Donnell nor the publisher of her former magazine will receive damages in their dispute over the publication's demise. Except, perhaps, for attorney's fees. Gruner & Jahr USA had sued O'Donnell for $100 million, alleging breach of contract. O'Donnell countersued for $125 million, saying the company broke its contract with her by cutting her editorial decisions. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
As Americans scramble to buy cheaper prescription drugs from Canada, Canadians are seeing their drug prices rise. Is there a connection? Some say yes. Jeff Poston is executive director of the Canadian Pharmacists Association. He joins us on the line from Ottawa. Hello, Jeff.
Hello there.
Well, first of all, why do you think that prices are on the rise? We know that prescription drugs typically cost about 30 to 50% less in Canada than in the U.S., but the cost has been going up.
I think is that we've certainly been concerned with the growth in the cross-border drug trade and the potential impact it has to lead to drug price increases in Canada. And I think we are now perhaps beginning to see some of those concerns being realized.
Well, in fact, drug makers like Pfizer, Canada, GlaxoSmithKline, Eli Lilly, they've been increasing the prices of many of their products. Which products are you seeing go up?
Well, I think is that what we've seen happen here is that some of those manufacturers that you've mentioned have actually increased the price of their products across the board. We're seeing sort of 4%. I've seen figures quoted between 4 to 8%, but certainly 4% seems to be common, and it seems to be across the board. Which obviously, for expensive products that are used in high volume, it means is that there's certainly going to be a significant impact on drug expenditures in Canada.
Well, and now you mentioned the cross-border purchase of drugs. Why do you think the drug companies would take this action of raising the prices in Canada?
First of all, we haven't seen price increases in Canada for some time. We have, as you know, our prices are controlled by a Patent Medicine Prices Review Board, and also there's some forms of price control over the drugs that are covered by our provincial drug benefit plans.
Which in fact, raises a question I was going to raise. How is it that drug companies can raise their prices? Because we thought it was government control.
Well, I think is that the guideline is that these are price increases for existing patented medicines, and the price increases are limited to changes in the consumer price index. So I think the companies will probably be arguing on this one is that their prices are in line with and in fact, they'll be arguing, I'm sure, is that they are less than what the consumer price index has been because they haven't raised prices for some time. But I think they are certainly sending a signal. The consequences that we see of the cross-border drug trade is potential price increases. We're also concerned about the ability of Canadians to access drugs, but also we're concerned that in the long run, why would a manufacturer launch a new drug in Canada simply to see it sold into the United States at a lower price than the U.S. Market?
Well, all in all, though, do Canadians, I mean, you speak to a lot of elderly, I'm sure you serve them. Are they worried that Americans are going to mess up their prescription drug care?
I think we're beginning to see that sort of concern. I was talking last week at a meeting to a number of patient advocate groups, and they're certainly very concerned both about they see the obvious long-term impact that this can have on prices, but they're also very concerned about the impact it could have on access to drugs, and particularly whether companies will launch new drugs in Canada. We already have a case where a company that has a new HIV AIDS drug is debating whether to launch it in Canada because of price issues. And certainly the patient advocate groups are very concerned about those sorts of developments.
Well, Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Poston, Executive Director of the Canadian Pharmacists Association.
Well, a fight over a common pesticide could have serious implications for the planet's ozone layer. Representatives from the United States and 180 other countries are meeting in Nairobi, Kenya this week to discuss a 1987 treaty that contained a timetable to eliminate a host of ozone-destroying substances, including methyl bromide. The European Union says the chemical is the biggest threat to the Earth's protective ozone shield. But the U.S. delegation in Nairobi says the chemical is irreplaceable and should be exempted from any future protocol. Joining us on the line is Andrew Revkin, a New York Times reporter who's been following the story. And welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us, Andrew. Methyl bromide, what is it and how do they use it?
It's been used for decades by farmers in a host of ways. To sterilize soils before you plant. It kills both weeds and pests, so it's kind of your all-purpose cleanser. It's like fantastic for the soil. Then you have a nice sterile base to grow your crops and you just add what you need.
But according to the Montreal Protocol of 1987, methyl bromide was scheduled to be eliminated, right?
Right. They added it to the treaty. There are many, many chemicals covered under this treaty. Most familiar ones are the spray can ingredients, that kind of thing. This one was added in 1992, and it's, as of 99, has been slowly phased out by developed countries, including the United States. Our use has been steadily dropping these last few years.
I mean, the U.S. signed that protocol, right? And even our own EPA has us on a timetable to eliminate methyl bromide altogether by 2005, according to the protocol. So what's going on?
Well, farmers are lobbying. That's mainly what's going on.
Yeah.
They see some unfair advantages under this treaty for developing countries that are excused from a phase out for another 10 years. And farmers here say, look, we can't afford the labor now to pick the weeds. We need to use this spray to kill them. Otherwise, for us, they define critical use, and so does the treaty, as something for which there's no either technical or reasonable substitute, meaning an unaffordable, something that's unaffordable.
Yeah, California Republican George Radanovich has called methyl bromide the only effective and affordable pesticide available for certain crops. So what do you think is going to happen in Nairobi?
It's not clear yet. I heard some hints that the U.S. is likely to get its way. It is. It often gets its way in situations like this. The European Union has been complaining quite loudly, but some European Union countries also are seeking some exemptions, not nearly as much as the U.S. is.
Though some in the European Union say there are good alternatives to methyl bromide, right?
Right. I interviewed a former farmer, a fumigator in the Netherlands, where the chemical was phased out in the 80s. 3,000 tons a year were used there, and they stopped using it altogether in the 80s. He said the people who've shifted to other alternatives have never looked back. So they contend there are lots of alternatives.
When will there be a decision in Nairobi?
Well, the minister-level meetings are Thursday and Friday, and that's when push will come to shove. And there's a lot of lobbying going on. Industry has its people over there. Environmental groups have their people over there. And In the great scheme of things, methyl bromide is sort of last on the list. The Montreal Protocol is considered the landmark environmental treaty of the 20th century. It is the one that has accomplished the most in terms of phasing out lots of things. And this is sort of the last big one. And the fear of some of the critics of the U.S. maneuver there is that this could open up the way to other ways to weaken the treaty.
Andrew Revkin of the New York Times. Thanks so much, Andrew.
You are welcome.
Still to come, had enough of the mainstream? A group of New Yorkers has an alternative.
You're listening to Here and Now.
A real-life drama is unfolding in Hollywood. Bit players include Gary Shandling and Steven Seagal. Set pieces include a dead fish and a rose. On the line is the woman who broke the story for Daily Variety, Janet Sprintz. Hello, Janet.
Hi, how are you, Robin?
I'm fine. What's caught everybody's attention is a reporter from the Los Angeles Times found a dead fish and a rose on her car.
It all began about a year and a half ago when a federal grand jury in Brooklyn was investigating racketeering among the longshoremen. There were extensive wiretaps, and one of the wiretaps turned up a conversation in which mob figures were extorting Steven Seagal.
The actor.
The actor.
So this reporter who found the dead fish and the rose in the aluminum pan on her car, she suspects that it was left there because she was pursuing this story about Steven Seagal, but left there by who?
Absolutely. It was really only a month after the Steven Seagal story broke that Anita Bush, a reporter for the L.A. Times, started investigating the connection between Seagal and the mob. She goes out to her car and finds a dead fish, as you said, and a rose and a note saying stop taped to her windshield. And that's exactly the question, who did it?
Well, and what's the suspicion?
They arrest a low-level ex-con named Alexander Proctor. He's charged with threatening Anita. He tells the police that he was hired by Anthony Pelicano on behalf of Steven Seagal to threaten Anita.
Anthony Pelicano, he's a private investigator. He was often hired by a top Hollywood lawyer. Allegedly, he was caught setting illegal wiretaps. So tell us more about Pelicano.
Anthony's flamboyant. He's famous. He's represented everyone. He's the opposite of the sort of discreet undercover cop.
Right. And now we enter onto the stage people like Gary Shandling,
right,
who's called by the FBI and informed that he's been one of the people wiretapped.
What happens is Pelicano denies any connection with Anita. However, the FBI raids his office and they find very interesting things. They find explosives in his office safe, hand grenades, C4, and they also find what has been described as the equivalent of 2 billion pages of wiretapping transcripts.
So what happens now? Is all of Hollywood in fear of finding their words on some wiretap transcripts?
Absolutely. This has been percolating really for weeks, if not months. It's been about a week that, Variety broke the story that Burt Fields, an absolutely, eminent central entertainment lawyer, acknowledged that he'd been interviewed by the FBI. He'd been subpoenaed by a grand jury. And since then, the names have just come pouring out, and there seems to be no end to them. It has snowballed into being, the scandal that is could take down Hollywood, which we get every few years.
Well, Janet, as you say at Daily Variety, this story has legs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Janet Schmintz, freelance writer for Daily Variety.
This show's got legs, too. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
You are the only man that can turn my stomach upside down. There ain't a man in New York City that's strong enough to turn your stomach upside down.
Today, we're saying goodbye to Art Carney. You may know him as Norton from The Honeymooners. The show was on from 1951 to 1956, but those 39 episodes in which Carney played a sewer engineer are evergreen.
I work in the sewer. It's a very hard job. You know they won't hire just any old slob. You don't have to wear a tie or a coat. You just have to know how to float.
But for residents of Westbrook, Connecticut, in the years after The Honeymooners ended, Art Carney was a local guy, a neighbor, who frequented the Westbrook supermarket, whose granddaughter played for the high school basketball team, and who helped fund many charitable causes around the town. Well, joining us on the line now is Butch Claffey from Bill's Seafood Restaurant, where Carney was a regular for lunch. Welcome, Butch.
Good afternoon.
Art Carney was a regular at your restaurant. Tell us about him.
Well, he was quite a nice gentleman. You know, he was always seen around town, and he was always allowed the privacy that he deserved. And, he was always very pleasant. He greeted everyone. There was nothing snooty about him at all. When he was in his hometown here, he was just one of the guys. He hung out in the center of town, and he was seen on a daily basis going there to get his newspaper and talking with his friend Cliff in the Westbrook Food Center.
Any particular memory, Butch, of Art?
Always enjoyed seeing him come in. He enjoyed his shrimp cocktail and scoot up to the ice cream shop and get some vanilla ice cream. And it was always it's quite an honor for us, because he was such a giant celebrity. So we were very, very pleased every time we saw him.
Going to miss him?
Yes, absolutely. But his children are around and his grandson, who I see quite regularly. So hopefully, the family name will continue.
Mm-hmm. Butch Claffey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, sir.
Butch Claffey joined us from Bill's Restaurant in Westbrook, Connecticut, former home of Art Carney, who passed away on Sunday.
Anybody know that I used to drive stock cars? I'm a ghost of 7-time Winston Cup NASCAR champion Dale Earnhardt.
Yeah!
That's all.
The ghost of the late NASCAR legend Dale Earnhardt, complete with Goodwrench overalls and racing accessories, is just one of the ridiculous acts at one of New York's underground guilty pleasures.
All right, look here. I made it to heaven. All right, I use that term as a joke. I made it to heaven. All right, so that must tell you that I was a good guy in life, and if I say something rude like that, it's for a cheap laugh, and I got it.
It's called Deep Dish Cabaret, an often offensive slice of Manhattan nightlife, staged in a small loft, which is used during the day as a tango dance studio. Deep Dish was created by Steve Kosloff.
Anything can happen on stage as long as I think the audience will enjoy it. The emphasis is definitely on comedy, but it's what we would call, in the trade, alternative comedy. People who are hysterically funny, but I think they're people you would not see in a comedy club because they're too weird.
Kosloff was dismayed at the state of New York City nightlife after moving to the city from Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where he'd worked as a journalist. Deep Dish is his answer to what he calls the Disneyfication of the Big Apple. Producer Karen Pellant recently attended an evening's entertainment.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen! Welcome to Deep Dish Cabaret. Thank you very much for coming.
Several dozen patrons packed the room, and I had found a comfy spot on one of the couches. It was then that I noticed a strange girl sitting behind me. She was wearing plastic troll ears, an eclectic mismatched ensemble, and she held a tote bag in which she carried a chihuahua. Thankfully, they turned out to be one of the acts. She is called Reverend Jen, and her dog, who sat complacently in the bag looking out at the crowd, is Reverend Jen Jr. They recently formed a gangsta rap band.
Okay, step up, bitches in the house. Welcome MC JJ. She's dynamite, keeping it real on the mic. Yo, homegirl, take it away. Now, this is Reverend Jen Jr. Comes on stage, and in my reality, she can talk. What's up, y'all? My name is JJ, and I don't play when I rock the mic. I am so fierce, I make Eminem shudder with fear. 5 pounds of attitude, call us nasty, call us rude. She puts Foxy in feminism, kicking fat beats, going brawless like Gloria Steinem. Busting rhymes like prom night hymen. She's off the hook, y'all.
Then there's Neil Medlin, a 20-something performance artist who did an absurd stream-of-consciousness striptease. Think Jim Carrey on a caffeine high, being electrocuted.
Lay your body here and watch my fingers walk. Take a second and imagine.
In this particular instance, I just had this R. Kelly song that's, like, very sexy, and then it has this big dramatic ending. I had a suit jacket and some. I have these, you know, panties with a big butterfly on them. Rub myself with the baby oil and what else did I do?
Let's see, there was something with a flower, and then used the poles.
Yeah, I had a flower. I tried to lick my toe on the pole, which will hurt later.
Give it up for Neil Medlin. As you can imagine, Neil has spent a lot of time on my casting couch.
I decided to check in with the audience. A guy sitting in the front row told me it was his first time at Deep Dish. I asked him what he thought.
Very interesting. I really enjoyed the last performer. He was great. He kind of put together a lot of different elements to make it interesting. You know, it's very spontaneous. It's cool. It's also nothing that's really sketched out, and it's very kind of a free-form kind of feel to it. It's just the kind of feel of the room. It's really getting away from that kind of standard kind of stand-up or improv kind of thing, which even though it says improv has its constraints, it seems. These guys kind of break down some of those barriers. It makes it interesting.
The performers agree. Adira Amram is one half of Quincy and Adira, a young vaudevillian singing-slash-acting performance duo. They sang a wistful, melancholy, and hilarious duet about a particular sexual position, which I don't think I can put on public radio. It was their first time at Deep Dish.
We've been playing a lot of, like, at the open mics, downtown, like, Collective Unconscious and Bowery Poetry Club. But this place is a lot more intimate because it is like a studio, a loft space. So we didn't really know what to expect when we got here because we had never seen this space. But it's a great space to perform because the audience is right there on the same level with you, so I hope we can come back.
I'm a degenerate. That's what the bourgeois said.
enter your slip with my yacht. Diamonds and pearls make me hot.
After the eighth and final performer graced and sullied the stage, people stuck around and socialized for a bit. And by 2 a.m., everybody was gone. Come Monday, a class of tango dancers would fill the room, blissfully unaware of what took place here just 2 days before.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play.
This type of an event, the feeling that you have walking in the door here and sitting down and watching these performers in someone's house, basically, it's what New York should be all about. And probably 30 years ago, it's what New York, what Lower Manhattan was all about. But increasingly, the nightlife is dominated by places where you have to spend $10 on a martini. It's not very imaginative. It's not very evocative. I had more fun in Phnom Penh, and that's a shame because New York's supposed to be the cultural capital of the United States or the world.
Come taste the wine, come hear the band, come blow the horn, start celebrating right this way, your table's waiting, no use.
Steve Kosloff, creator and producer of Deep Dish Cabaret. Our visit was produced by Karen Pelland. For more information and pictures, go to our website, here-now.org.
Start by admitting from cradle to tomb, ain't such a long, long stroll. Life is a cabaret, oh, chum, come to the cabaret.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Life is a cabaret, old chum, come to the cabaret. Life is a cabaret, old chum, come to the cabaret. Call me a cabaret, I love a cabaret.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
The UN issues a report on the wall that divides the West Bank from Israel.
And Russia's famed ballet company, the Kirov. It's touring the U.S. We go backstage.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.